Hello, friends, and welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comic Extension. With me, as always, is Nicole M.
Hello.
Chris Casso.
Hello.
And, of course, Mr. Cole Hornaday.
Hey, so the holiday season is just wrapping up, but looking forward to next year. I got to put it to y'all. How naughty do I need to be next holiday season to ensure that Krampus will come and take me away?
You want that to happen?
Look, my life is a living hell as it is already. I would be blessed to be stuck in a wicker basket and be whipped by twigs for an eternity. In fact, that sounds lovely.
Well, see me after the show. I may know somebody.
After looking at current politics, you have to try really hard.
Yeah.
Okay, well, just like plan ahead for me. You know, it'll be the birthday season and all. So,
Just think Grinch everywhere you go.
Yeah, this is like Grinch, like, squared.
Yeah.
Because horns.
That's fair.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for indulging me. Hey, Ben. Hey.
You know, it's funny. Right before I came here today, I was scrolling through the Twitters, as you do. And a friend of the show and one-time guest, John Boylan, retweeted a tweet from Philip Hester, who tweeted something that I think is I thought was a lot of fun. And I'm going to repeat it for you now.
He said...
You can't break into comics. We're closed. The moose outside should have told you. Which, if you don't know what that's from, email me at perfectbombpodcast@gmail.com. If you know where that's from, what that he's referencing, then maybe there might be a prize in it for you.
But it's not Northern Exposure, is
no,
it?
No, it's not Northern Exposure.
Don't try to guess. People have to email in.
Well, now it's going to... I'm not going to
It will
remember.
Haunt your dreams, no doubt. But you must keep those lips sealed.
Let's not talk about my dreams right now.
That'll be a nice break
from the
nightmares.
Welcome to the Dreamcast, everyone.
Speaking of dreams, what do we got going on here at the Comic Dungeon coming up?
Next segue.
Nap time.
So we will be having a huge end-of-the-year sale. It'll start on the 26th, which is a Wednesday, and go into January 2nd, which is also a Wednesday. And back issues will be a big, big, big part of it. We need to blitz through them and make room for all the other back issues that we're still processing and have many boxes of. We have a fort in the back right now. So that's
come on.
We'll have other things for sale, but buy the back issues. But yeah, that's about all we've got on the way.
Yeah. Anything
As usual, we have book club coming up on December 14th. We're going to be reading and discussing Hellboy, the new omnibus editions, which are formatted a little differently, but should be fun to discuss.
Cool. And is that here, or is that at Corner Comics, or both?
It's here at Comics Engine. Okay. Yeah, it's the Comics Engine one I'm still running. Yep.
Right on.
Yeah.
We should also mention that we do have Groupons available for Corner Comics.
Yeah.
However, when you go search for it, it'll just say Comics Dungeon, and we couldn't get them to change that because they're special.
Yep.
And
but they say they have two locations, and you can use it at both locations.
Exactly.
So. Yep. So you can come visit me and get discounts. Yeah.
All right. So, friends, this episode is coming to you. This is episode 200. Can you believe
this,
that?
Oh, this is the 200th
what?
Episode.
This is the 200th episode.
I thought we were going to make a bigger deal about this.
I know. So did I. Well,
well, who did the bad math, Ben Lawrence?
I told you all it was coming up.
I would have come up with a cheesier opening than the stupid Krampus
joke.
You all
got the show notes at the same time I did. And,
but we only sort of read them.
Nobody reads what I send to you anyway.
Also,
like,
no,
I don't need to prepare.
You kind of make it sound like you're going to be doing stuff out of order in the recording.
Well, we kind of have been doing that, but this is episode 200.
Okay, 200.
We have a pretty important subject, though.
Cake. Yeah.
We could have gotten, like, those popper things.
I would have liked
fireworks,
cake.
Fireworks, smoke.
Today's December 10th, 2018.
Pull a rabbit out of a hat.
We're a little late getting to this news because this news happened right after we recorded a whole bunch of episodes, and so we're going to be talking about it now. It may seem a little bit after the fact, but who cares? People listen to podcasts years after the fact, so what do you know? All right, so Stan Lee passed away at the age of 95. All right. So I want to say 94 because George H.W. Bush just passed away, and he was 94. Mm-hmm. So that's why I was getting confused. Anyway, Let's talk about Stan Lee, his legacy. He was, whatever you thought of him, he was the face of comics these days. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, was he a jerk to Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko? did he earn his fame? What y'all got?
Yes to everything.
All right, moving on.
It's one of those cases, because I've had to talk about it a few times with customers at the store,
I bet,
where it's important to note that, the good doesn't wash away the bad doesn't wash away the good. So it's just good to understand the different things that have happened and to be able to talk about them and be able to, just approach it from a stance of, it was very a tangled web.
Yeah.
From all the business dealings, from Jack Kirby, from the Steve Ditko, and plenty of other people, but also even the last couple years of his life with the sexual misconduct problems and all the mob connections and some other weird things with his family estate.
And pilfering as well.
Yeah.
And exploiting him as a person.
Yeah. This past year.
Very tragic.
Yeah, especially.
As I'm usually want to do, to launch in and blow hot and hard, I've done a lot of thinking about this because I have very, very low opinion of Stan Lee. But what I am going to say is that I think that because I watched a lot of social media flaming going on, particularly around memes where folks had posted these illustrations of a weeping or mourning Stan Lee embracing all this cluster of Marvel characters. And what I found particularly offensive about that was that there were characters in the mix that people liked, but they weren't characters that he created. Mm-hmm. And that was just kind of the aura that he created around himself, was that he was an incredibly successful self-promoter. Now, there's an upside to that, and there, of course, is the downside. Mm-hmm. And the upside to that is that he put comics in the early 60s, particularly Marvel comics, on the pop culture map.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a big thinker. He was a money maker. He was not a particularly good storyteller, but he was a great marketer.
Mm-hmm. And he really wanted to get into movies and things
he
that.
Had big dreams.
He tried for that for decades, you know.
And you need to remember that he wrote diligently, he collaborated diligently through the 60s, but then come the 70s, he was going to go to Hollywood. He was going to take Marvel property. The things that he lived to see are really awesome, mm-hmm. because all those dreams he had of selling and marketing and doing all these amazing things and the Marvel blockbuster movies, that's what he dreamed about doing. Mm-hmm. And those things would not have happened had he not been so relentless and shameless and egocentric in his promotion. But there are a lot of creative people that went by the wayside who went to their graves paupers, Go back and watch our Howard the Duck episode and learn about how, every illustrator, every comic book creator in that bullpen that he dubbed, they all had to, it was stamped on the back of their check that their work was freelance and they didn't get to own anything. And it was Steve Gerber who, took them to task on that. And he went broke fighting it. So what was the point I was going to make? I think it really behooves everybody, because I did go off and start being nasty, to read some books about the history of Marvel comic books and to get your hands on, some objective journalism. The book that I highly recommend is called Marvel Comics, The Untold Story by Sean Howe. He does do some editorial evaluating, but most of it, he took all of that, he plucked that from previously published interviews and articles, so I trust that the sources, I trust that he comes off with some objective history, and guess what? Stan's not painted in a particularly positive light. And I'm, I got a bias for Jack Kirby, so I'm going to recommend two Jack Kirby books that I think do tell it like it is, and one's called Tales to Astonish, Jack Lee, Stan Lee, and the American Comic Book Revolution by Ronan Rowe, and the other one I reviewed on the podcast years ago called Kirby, King of Comics by Mark Evanier.
Mm-hmm. I will also make a reading recommendation. It is from the Comics Journal website, and it's an article called The Strange Case of Stan Lee by Austin English.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that one resonated for me is that English is 1 year younger than me. Mm-hmm. And everything that he mentioned, his exposure to Stan Lee lined up with my exposure, from basically being introduced by seeing a Marvel trading card that had Stan Lee as the creator of the Marvel Universe. And so the article does a very interesting job of breaking down different aspects of Stan's life, of his career. There's a very interesting section that I wasn't aware of about his Wally Wood, which is, I think, worth mentioning very briefly here, that like Wally Wood was working on Daredevil with Stan Lee. And at, I think it's like number 10 of Daredevil, they went in for the Marvel method of a conference, basically. And the entire time, like, Stan Lee just kind of stared at Wally. And they had silence for quite a while until Wally, like, made the story. And then he wanted, like, well, I would like to get paid as the writer and the artist because I did everything. And Stan was like, oh, I'll look into it, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da. And then he is like, give me the scripts for the next issue. And he did the scripts. And Stan Lee said, these are terrible. I can't do anything with these. I'm going to have to rewrite the whole thing. It was published, and only 5 words were changed. And then Wally Wood never got the next job. So he was just like, yep, that's the end of that.
So, Chris, I think we might want to double back and talk a little bit about what the Marvel method was.
Sure, yes, yeah.
Go ahead.
Because I only learned what that was just like within this last year.
Okay.
Right? The Marvel method.
I think Eric Larson posted a description, his understanding of it. And it was basically that they would go in for a creative session and Stanley would basically tell them, like, this is what's supposed to happen. And then they would go draw it and plot it. And then basically put, like, between the lines notes about, like, this is where this should say this and da-da-da. And then he would put the script in. Mm-hmm. And so that's there's really not that many scripts you could find, any original scripts, because it was all kind of concocted out of this weird quagmire of the collaboration.
And you can even see Stan Lee say just about that much in interviews, because I did watch a few after he passed away because they were everywhere. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he would say that. He would say, like, I would throw a concept out. He was like, I was really busy editing and doing all these other things. So I would meet with artists. I would give them, like, a quick, like, elevator pitch. Mm-hmm. They'd go. They'd do the whole work. They'd come back. I'd throw in whatever I wanted to throw in. And that was it.
Yep.
So, yeah. I mean, it was also validated by
so
him,
so you will
too.
Not find, you know... When I was a kid, I, you know, had this dream of being a comic book writer. And I just assumed, having spent time in theater and being in love with movies, that there was some type of script that was broken down scene by scene, you know, not unlike a play or a teleplay or a movie script. And that's not how... And I remember talking to professionals, sending them my scripts, and I think even Mike Allred wrote me back and said... Yeah, this is not how it's done. This is a great script. It's really fun. I can see what you want to, the story you want to tell, but that's not how they do it. And I was just, like, totally befuddled by, and that Marvel method kind of evolved where, you know, they would brainstorm ideas, the artist would go away, draw pictures, and then, and I think they still do this, and then the writer would sit then and plug in the text. And I'm like, that just sounds like the most stultifying thing. Mm-hmm. But that is how the Marvel method evolved. So you're not going to find Stan Lee comic book scripts archived anywhere because they don't exist. What you will find are, like, say, Jack Kirby, Bill Everett, Steve Ditko's panel boards with tons of marginalia all around. Mm-hmm. And to me, to this day, I still don't understand how that could possibly be productive. But they succeeded at it. Yeah. I just don't get it.
I have a weird detail question regarding the Marvel method. Maybe any of you know this. When Jack Kirby or Steve Ditko would go off and plot the story and they would bring the boards back to Stan to put the script in, did they have speech bubbles already, and Stan had to write within the speech bubbles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. In one of the interviews, he had said that they would put those in, and he would just write them in.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yep.
See, I just don't think.
Yeah, it's a lot of foresight, right? Yeah. To have to like, what are they going to say, where and how? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That the whole process just I could never get my head around it, and it was Kirby who I think finally stepped up and said, "This is malarkey. I should be getting co-credit for this, mm-hmm. and not just as artist because I am writing these stories, Stanley." And Stanley said, "Well, no, you're not, Jack."
It was interesting to see the progression of credits on the front covers during this early time, because a number of websites would have screen grabs of what the covers looked like, and it would constantly change. You can see like Stan's influence slowly like take over.
Yep.
Yeah. All the credits on these covers.
Yeah. Part of the collaboration method, like when I was reading about some Black Panther stuff, originally it was going to be called the Cold Tiger, and that was Jack Kirby's plans, and he had a different costume design, and so Stan's the one that changed the name to Black Panther, and then said we're going to put the mask on, and we'll change this here and there. So I mean, the collaboration yielded some very, very good results, you know? It's just who took credit of those results is the other part of the issue.
And who made a living on what they were doing and how.
Right.
There's a quote from the article I mentioned that was talking about what Cole had mentioned, where the media blitz that Stanley put out there of promoting Marvel and everything. Mm-hmm. And it's just, the quote goes that it created a misconception of cartooning on the public stage that the medium still hasn't untangled.
Yeah.
Right.
On every level. I went to a party years ago and somebody was convinced that Stan Lee created Transformers and G.I. Joe just because.
Well,
that's
how successful he was.
Yeah, ingrained himself so deeply.
Self-promotion.
Yep. Stan Lee is comics.
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't bother to fight with people and say, he didn't create Captain America. He didn't create Wolverine. He didn't create Deadpool.
So there's some corporate mentality that he embraced and he pushed in there. Not as a counterpoint, but as a balance, I kind of wanted to bring up. Because in the last decade especially, but maybe the last 20 years if we're generous, he slowed down a little bit with that persona. Like, the persona was definitely out there, but he would take breaks and he would actually help people. And there's a really nice thread from Gail Simone that I read the other day where she was at a convention and him and some other media corporate person suddenly surprised the panel and came out to be part of the panel. And then he was introduced to her and he'd never met her before. And he was just like, "What do you do?" And she's just like, "I'm just a writer." And he stopped and she said, he turned off the Stan Lee completely and talked to her and said, "Don't ever say you're just the writer." And so he helped her get through her punishing herself for not thinking she was worthwhile. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So he had that ability to be able to talk to people and get to them and help them.
Our friend Adam, he was talking about how I can't remember how it goes, but he always saw Stan Lee as this absent father or grandfather figure because he had a read-along book that was Marvel characters, and it was Stan Lee narrating it. And Adam felt very strongly that Stan Lee helped him learn how to read as a result of narrating this book. And I'm like, "Oh, well, I can't diss on that." Mm-hmm. That's great. Anyway, what were you going to say?
I mean, even though he has done a lot of damage, there's a lot of other creators who have done the same thing. It was kind of part of the system in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And he has had moments where he's made seemingly sincere acknowledgments of people and how much work they actually put in and how much work he actually put in. Mm-hmm. So he has had those moments as well.
Yeah.
Being able to acknowledge people and say like, "Hey, remember that Jack Kirby did a lot of work," mm-hmm. So it's like, I know sometimes it can be a little sour grapes because it's just like, "Well, why didn't you do something at the time?"
Right.
But I still think having acknowledgement and putting their names out there is important because people still don't know who Jack Kirby is.
Yeah.
You know?
There's another thing that's worth hunting down. I don't have the link on the website or anything on me, but there was a resurfaced photo of Jack Kirby. Well, I shared it with you guys, so you might find it.
Oh, yeah.
A resurfaced photo of Jack Kirby and Stan at a convention and that no one had ever seen before. And they're friendly with each other. And this is definitely after all the bad stuff. It's worth noting that, like, Jack Kirby in an interview afterwards did say, like, it doesn't change anything. Stan still Stan and everything's still there, but we can at least, you know, be adults and be in this, you know.
So, Chris, the article that you mentioned earlier about
the strange case of Stan Lee.
So I put that on the Panel Jumper Facebook page if you want to go visit that and scroll down. And also if you subscribe to the Comics Dungeon rant, I think Chris included it in the rant a couple of weeks ago as it is a very good article. I try to actually be a little bit objective and post different articles on the Panel Jumper page that kind of gave a broader spectrum of the man's contribution to comics and put my particular personal bias aside. But I think the thing that I just want to put on the table is that a lot of folks were mourning the passing and beating their chests over the loss of Stan Lee. And I was kind of like, have you ever actually read any of the comics he purported to write?
You know what was the word?
Because you're going to have an entirely different perspective on these charming comic books. Go ahead.
You know what the worst one of those was that I saw? Was somebody drew a picture of God in heaven embracing Stan Lee and saying welcome. It's just like, you do know he's Jewish. it's not going to quite play that way for him in that religion.
Nope. There's something that I've been discovering of late. There's been a passing of a lot of prominent public figures, and the meme magic that happens on social media, and it's a lot of self-aggrandizement happening. It's like you don't really know who that person is, and you're glorifying them. And yeah, it's probably tacky to speak ill of the dead, but let's just take a close look at history.
Well, hey, to counterpoint, we've spoken ill of him while he was alive. We're not really doing anything different than we've done before.
Right. So, but, if you want to get a
we treat dead people fairly across the board.
That's right.
I mean, please go read the Marvel Essential phone book editions of all the black and white things. Are those still in print?
Not the essentials. No, they're out of print.
All right. They're not hard to find.
I have them at Corner Comics. Why don't you hit me up?
Great.
I got a lot of them.
Like, that's when I read all 110 issues that Kirby and Lee did together of the Fantastic Four, and I got all those. And that was a great learning experience in learning about history. But, I hadn't actually read comics that Stan Lee purported to pen until the 90s. DC Comics did this weird project called Imagine Stan Lee.
Don't read those. That's what I was about to mention. Just don't read those.
So this was a project that you'd think would be really exceptional and kind of brilliant, where Stan is going to reimagine DC characters.
Don't read them.
With popular artists of the day. And there are great artists. There's like Chris Baclo and
John Cassidy.
Oh yeah, there's all kinds of it's a universe that he builds, and there's an arc, and there's a bookend books, and they're perfect bound books. And back in the day, they were like $6.99, $7.99, and there's probably like 12 of them.
8 to 10, something like that.
Yeah. It felt like 12. Quits.
Yes, it did. Don't read that.
But I mean, they are excruciatingly bad.
Oh,
okay. Let's not dwell on the negative too far. Yeah.
The artwork is all great.
They're very pretty.
Like, the words.
Yes. So look, he's clearly made a huge impression on the world, and we're in a stage now where geek culture is like popular culture, right?
Yes,
there's
these
great movies on the screen. Well, some of them, and we have this whole world that we didn't have before, and I think that he's a huge part of that. He's largely responsible for that, and some people know comics because Stan Lee.
Yep.
So it is important to acknowledge that he had a really big deal in this in this whole culture and where we are now. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he was also maybe shady. So, he's a human being, right? So We've made mistakes in the world, and some are greater than others, but he's clearly made a large impact.
And I think that is a great way to wrap up our Stanley discussion, and let's move on to Book Report, everybody. And let's start with Cole Hornaday. What do you got for us this week?
Oh, man, that's a hard call. So I'm going to start with the trade edition of Infidel, written by Pornsock Pickenshote and illustrated by Aaron Campbell, and colors by Jose Villarubia. This is a book that I read about a lot. It's collected five issues, and it is a very modern horror story. In fact, right here on the cover is selected for NPR's 100 Favorite Horror Stories of All Time. And that was a listicle that I got mired in about a year ago, and it took me a long time to come out because I was fascinated by a lot of it. Chris read the first issue, and it didn't do anything for me, for him, rather. Mm-hmm. It had a terrific impact on me. I think this is one of the best horror comics I've read in a very long time. The mood, the tone, the artwork is superb, and it moves cinematically. I bet you a nickel that Pickenshote wanted to pitch this as a film. I think it's actually been sold as a film at present. So the story is really naughty, K-N-O-T-T-Y, and the forefront of the story is all about dealing with horror in a ghost story context. Our lead character and Aisha, who is a Muslim woman, American Muslim woman, has married a white Protestant male widower, and who has a young daughter, and the three of them are living with the husband's mother, who's a retired physician, who is quietly and pleasantly racist. You know, it's like, you know, smiling, but then says crummy things about, the evil of wearing a hijab and things like that. Aisha's is, they all live in this building that was a few months before partially demolished due to a terrorist act. The downstairs neighbor was actually building chemical bombs, and one of the other neighbors, and this is what I don't get, this is a little problem with the story, but he was storing all the incendiaries that were liquid bombs on the landing in the apartment building. So blows out that floor, kills everybody on that floor, makes the rent really cheap, so they all move in there. Aisha starts being plagued by these wraith-like beings that she can see, and then some of her friends can see. And it quickly goes to hell. And I found myself really caring about these characters, and it doesn't end well. But there was this filtering of the none too subtle racism all around this woman and her friends and her family. And you kind of asking yourself, is that fear and anxiety being manifested through these horrific creatures that are plaguing her and causing her life and making her life hell, or are they really there? That's where it actually started to work on me and be really, really scary. And I thoroughly enjoyed reading this. I highly recommend it. I think it's an excellent modern horror story.
Cool. Infidel.
Infidel.
Thank you, Cole. Nicole, what do you got for us?
A Queero comic, yay!
What?
Okay, so this is like a post-apocalyptic romance erotica.
Nice.
Yeah.
Right up your alley.
It's good times. Yeah, it's like I picked it, or actually Chris picked it and said, you need this, and I said, yes, as usual. So this one is called Open Earth, and it's by Sarah Merck, Ava Cabrera, who's done the Kim and Kim series that I love, and Claudia Aguirre. And there's a space station that is floating around Earth because the Earth has become uninhabitable. And this girl, Rigo, has been born and raised on this space station. Her parents are a monogamous married couple, And but she is, because things are changing, cultural norms and rules are changing, she's more into like a poly situation. So she sees somebody casually and she sees some other people casually, but she finds that there's this one person that she actually feels like romantic feelings for, like she might want to date, and she gets really nervous and shy about it and is trying to figure out like how best to go about it, because she's just navigating that for kind of the first time. And there's like some little sexy bits in there, and there's a lot of fun, just lots of fun moments, and the art is very whimsical. Overall, it's just really fun. It's not like super raunchy or anything. It's just like nude people being nude together. But there's just a lot of fun to be had in it, and I really enjoyed it. So that's pretty much it.
Cool.
If you want something fun and nudie, it's it should be noted that it is by Limerence Press, which is the erotica offshoot of Oni, the imprint. And they haven't really been producing a ton of stuff, but I'm glad that they've been doing a little bit more. And then one more thing is that the pull quotes are, just to give you an idea of kind of the flavor of this, one of the pull quotes is from Erica Moen, who does Ojoy Sex Toy, who also has something at this imprint, and Hazel Nulevant, who did something called Sugar Town, which was also another comic about a polyamorous relationship. For those who don't know, polyamorous is people dating multiple people and everyone being like real cool about it. So, yeah. I'm really done now.
Okay. Okay, thank you, Nicole. finally, Chris Cassell, what do you got?
I read a new graphic novel from Kaboom, and it is called Pandora's Legacy, written by Kara Leopard and drawn by Kelly and Nicole Matthews, who were the twins that did our variant covers for Faith.
Yay.
A few years ago. So this is a fun story about two twin sisters and their brother. And they're on their way to go visit their grandmother and extended family. And they step out of their car on the way and take a quick walk break in the woods. And they stumble across this really weird shack that has a bunch of Greek statues and an urn. And they knock over the urn. And, oh, no, it was Pandora's box. And it turns out that they are descendants of the line of Pandora. And that people in this family may have to be guardians, have to put all the monsters back from time to time. Their little cat named Poe is a fat, chubby little cat with little chubby legs. He gets possessed with the spirit of Prometheus, so they call him Prometheus. And one of them accidentally takes like a picture. I like the delayed gratification on that.
Well, it was you weren't watching my face. Oh. It bloomed.
Oh. Yes, it did. It bloomed. Nice. Absolutely.
One of them has a phone, and they accidentally take a picture of one of the monsters, and it disappears, and its soul goes into the phone. Oh. And so that's like the modern version of how they have to capture them. So they're learning all about this, and they confront like mermaids, and they meet a new friend, and then the what's the spider lady name? I forget her name. Slithlow? Snith? I don't know. There's a Gorgon and there's a couple others. And so there might be more of it coming, but it also kind of tidies things up a certain way by the end of the book. And I really appreciated it. There's a couple sequences where the action's a little muddled. Like I can't quite tell who's saying what, but it's brief and it's just, you know, whatever. So it is a very fun read. It's only $10. It's got some beautiful artwork, neat monsters. If you like mythology, it's great. And it's totally age appropriate. So I highly recommend it. It's a lot of fun.
Cool. Pandora's Legacy. Thank you, Chris.
Yeah.
Well, that is Book Report. That is our show. Coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by the Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com, as well as Comics Dungeon here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes or however you get your podcasts at perfectboundpodcast.com. Send us an email, perfectbumpodcast@gmail.com. And I swear one of these days I'm going to get through this closing thing without screwing up. Well, all right.
You know, stop and breathe every once in a while. There you go. Yeah.
Get your quiz hats on, everybody. It's quiz time this week. The questions come to us from me.
What?
And come on, who else is this going to be about? Here are five questions about Stanley. I want to say that the basis for these questions came from a website called Factinate.com, but in researching the questions, I came to find out that Factinate.com got some of their Factinates wrong. Dude! So here are some uncharacteristically researched multiple choice questions. Swear to God, I put way too much time into this.
Did you hurt yourself?
Oh my God. Number one, in 1998, Lee signed a contract with Marvel, making him chairman emeritus, paying him an $800,000 annual salary to reach 1 mil by 2002, and only requiring him to work approximately 10 to 15 hours a week as a representative of Marvel. What does Factinate say was also in this contract, but isn't? A, a special clause in the agreement states that Lee must appear in any film based on one of his characters. B, Stan Lee must never change his signature looks as his likeness is trademarked by Marvel. Or C, had to sign a secret affidavit saying that Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko really did all the hard creative work.
So what did they get wrong?
This is actually a common misconception about this contract. In fact, I just picked up on it.
B.
No, it is not B. It is A. I did so, A, which is a clause in his agreement stating that he must appear in any film based on a character he created. I guess this was a common misconception. I read the contract, and oddly enough, it's available online. The closest language that comes to, quote, you must appear in our movies is from paragraph 2, section C, which states, and I quote, work with motion picture and television producers and distributors to stimulate their licensing of Marvel characters and supervise movie and television projects of Marvel characters on Marvel's behalf and be named executive producer or co-executive producer of such productions. Lee was also to be given a, end quote there. So that's what the contract says. Lee was also to be given 10% of the profits from all Marvel-based movies for which he sued Marvel in 2002 for not fulfilling those terms. The law suit was settled in 2005 and put in motion Marvel's plans to stop selling off the licensing rights to their characters and start producing their own movies. So something came from that. All right, here's one I could not confirm. One of Lee's early jobs was purportedly what? A, a night janitor at the New York Times, which is where he said he got his inspiration for J. Jonah Jameson. B, writing anti-mortem obituaries of celebrities for an undisclosed news source. Or C, a personal assistant to Howard Hughes, an obvious inspiration for Tony Stark. You two seem to think you know what it is.
Obituaries.
It is obituaries. And if you don't know, an anti-mortem obituary is an obituary written before someone has passed away. So a news source has it at the ready, and no doubt the AP had one waiting to go when Lee passed away on November 12th, 2018. The problem with this one is everywhere I looked, almost the same phrasing was used. Quote, Stan Lee wrote anti-mortem obituaries for celebrities at an undisclosed news office in New York. He says that he eventually quit that job because it was too depressing. I couldn't find that quote attribution nor any official source claiming to have proof of this, so you and I are just going to have to take the internet's word on this.
Uh-oh.
All right, number three. Lee enlisted in the Army in November 1942 and was assigned to the Signal Corps, where he learned to string and repair communication lines. Once his superior officers found out he wrote and edited comics, they did what? A, sent him overseas to give superhero-like motivational speeches to the soldiers on the front lines to keep morale up. B, had him create an army comic for the soldiers so that but that soon came to an end because he didn't have a Jack Kirby or a Steve Ditko on base with him. Or C, transferred to him to the training film division, where he, along with other artists, filmmakers, and writers, made a range of public relations pieces, propaganda tools, and information sharing documents.
C.
It is C. Other notable members of the training film division include It's a Wonderful Life director Frank Capra, New Yorker cartoonist Charles Adams, and Theodore Geisel, who we all know as Dr. Seuss. Number four. We all know about Lee bucking the comics code of authority in 1971 when Marvel published a story where Peter Parker has to deal with Harry Osborn's drug problem. What led Lee to push the story? A. His own best friend had just passed away from a heroin overdose. B. The Department of Health, Education, and Welfare asked him to publish an anti-drug message. Or C. Lasting resentment over Frederick Wortham and the institution of the CCA drove Lee to go against it any chance he got.
B.
It is B. Les Daniels quotes Lee in his book Marvel, Five Fabulous Decades of the World's Greatest Comics, quote, I got a letter from the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare which said, in essence, that they recognized the great influence that Marvel Comics and Spider-Man have on young people, and they thought it would really be beneficial if we created a story warning kids about the dangerous effects of drug addiction. We were happy to help out. And incidentally enough, the drug issue of Spider-Man is credited as being the beginning of the end for the Comics Code of Authority. And finally, number five, in 2008, Stan Lee was the first comic book creator to win what? A. A Razzie for his cameo in Iron Man. B. A Presidential National Medal of Arts. Or C. A year's supply of Rice-A-Roni, the San Francisco treat.
B.
It is B. As of 2015, Stan Lee is the only comic book creator to win the National Medal of Arts because the current administration has yet to present the award for 2016 and beyond. That is quiz time, and that is our show. Woo-hoo! Thank you for watching, and we will see you next week. Yeah.